Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. Now, I do need to make a shout out to the incredibly good dad whom I found in the parking lot with a small boy and a baby. And he was prepared to sit it out there while I presume one of you was in here.
Yeah, he's so nice.
Right. So Stacy and I conducted him to the back room of the bookstore, and they are currently in the kitchen, and we have provided drawing paper and Sharpies. Not for the baby, but... Now, what really impressed me about this dad, because I thought moving two kids would be sort of a challenge, is that little boy rides on his shoulders, and he carries the baby, and the baby... You know, whatever. And I was really impressed by that. So anyway, they're safe and they're warm. So you can now enjoy this evening. Right. So Stacy, great to see you.
Great to see you again.
Thank you. So you've come here from Charleston, is that right?
Yes, Charleston, South Carolina.
Okay. And we're here to talk about your third book called Only If You're Lucky.
That is correct.
Right. Which seems to me, you know, my experience of college was dramatically different than the one in this book. Stanford University in 1958, girls actually had curfews. We had to wear dresses on campus. We were not allowed alcohol in the door. I know, it sounds like the Stone Age. It was. It was Mrs. Stanford's will, and it was only broken when Stanford opened its first overseas campus, and they had to put the boys and girls together in Florence, Italy, because that was the only, you know, dormitory that was available. So when I read your book, I had some trouble believing it.
Well, thankfully, most of the stuff in there is fictional, the murder stuff. But did you read the author's note at the end?
I did.
Yeah, so the setting is based on a real place. Do you want me to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, no, it's your book. Give us a pitch.
Sure. So Only If You're Lucky is my elevator pitch, I guess, is about a college freshman named Margot who is very shy. She's very withdrawn, and she's grieving the death of her high school best friend. So her and her best friend from high school were supposed to go to college together. They were supposed to room together. They had these kind of grand plans. And then the summer after their senior year, her best friend Eliza suddenly and unexpectedly died. And so Margot finds her, she finds herself alone in this dorm freshman year, and she's kind of unable to crack out of her shell until she is approached by a girl down the hall named Lucy, who is kind of the opposite of Margot in every way. Lucy is charismatic and confident and charming, and she invites Margot to live with her and three other girls in a house off campus. And because Margot is kind of starved for belonging, she's starved for that feeling that she had in high school with Eliza, she says yes. She doesn't really have any other options. And it's kind of the start of something beautiful that summer that they all get to know each other. They become fast friends, and Margot finds her place. And then because this is a thriller, it quickly goes south after that when one of the fraternity boys who lives in the house next door is brutally murdered. Lucy goes missing without a trace, and Margot is stuck in the center of the investigation. So the setting, the house that all those girls lived in college, was inspired by the house I lived in college. My five roommates and I actually lived in a house owned by a fraternity. They used it for the brothers would live in it when they had especially big pledge classes. But when they had smaller pledge classes and they didn't need the rooms, they would rent it out to people for cheap. And so, so my friends and I lived in this house owned by a fraternity. The fraternity boys were our landlords. The rent that went about as well as you would expect. The rent was ridiculously cheap, but there were very quirky things about the house that we came to find over the years that we lived there. And I incorporated all those things into the book.
So there's a really hot genre called dark academia or the dark academic setting. And I does this book really qualify for dark academia?
So technically, I don't think it does, because there's like certain elements of dark academia that are always kind of there. It's usually in like a very prestigious boarding school or an Ivy League school, kind of a gothic setting. Oftentimes the students study like classical literature or Shakespeare. Sometimes they're a little bit pretentious, and that doesn't really qualify here. This school is a small liberal arts college set in coastal South Carolina. It takes place mostly in the middle of the summer when it's kind of hot and humid, and then the kids spend a lot of time out on the water and on the beach. So I kind of call it like my twist on dark academia, because I always wanted to write a dark academia book, but all of those elements are not really my style. So I wanted to create a college campus murder mystery in the style that I typically write in.
So, I mean, a classic is Donna Tartt's The Secret History. Or many of you might have seen the Robin Williams movie, the name of which I can't ever remember, but it was, you know, what was it?
Yeah, the Dead Poets Society.
Yeah, the Dead Poets Society, right. That is sort of more classic. So it seemed to me that this book was really about bad choices and bad parenting, which possibly we can all relate to. And I think it's important, you know, to remember, I can't relate to the living experience that you have, but I can relate to bad choices when I was going to college. And I think that's when you're the most vulnerable. You know, when you leave home, and it could be either sex. I mean, it isn't just girls, you know. Guys make bad choices, too. And you've left home, and if there's no governance, you know, much as I hated Mrs. Stanford's will, in a way it prevented us from doing even stupider things that we actually did do. Also drove the boys to go up to Mills College and date the girls there, because it was so much work to date the Stanford girls. But that's, you know, another question. But anyway, I got married when I was a senior. So, you know, I was able to survive all that. But anyway, do you agree that bad choices, you know, made by the girls, or at least uninformed choices, if not bad choices.
A lot of bad choices. Yep. Yeah. But I like your point about, like, at that age, at such a vulnerable age. I use the word malleable in the book a lot to describe one of the characters, because I feel like when you're that age, when you're 17, 18, you go off to college, you're really malleable. Like, this isn't a blanket statement, but oftentimes you don't really know who you are at that age. You don't have a very strong sense of self. You want more than anything to belong, especially if you're new and you don't know anyone. And so when Margot finds herself in this situation where she suddenly belongs and she's being accepted by people, and that's kind of all she really wanted, she's malleable, and then the girls who accept her are kind of able to like mold her into whatever they want her to be. Thus the bad choices.
Let's not even mention hormones, but that has a lot to do with it too, because, you know, there are changes still going on in people's bodies and, you know, all sorts of stuff. I think, you know, if you don't come with a very strong moral compass and a sense of who you are, it leaves you really vulnerable.
Yeah.
To other people and to events.
Yeah, and I there was actually a true crime case that slightly inspired Only If You're Lucky that I can talk about for a little bit. Has anyone ever heard of the cult at Sarah Lawrence College? Yeah. Yeah. So for those who may not know, back in, I think it was 2010, Sarah Lawrence College is a real college, and there was I watched a documentary a couple years ago when I was plotting this book, and it gave me a lot of ideas. And essentially, a bunch of students all moved in together in a house off campus. They were all very bright, smart, promising kids, and they were all best friends. And it was just like this wonderful new chapter of them living off campus together and having all this freedom. And one day, one of the roommates' dads moved in. And that sounds really weird, but the way that it was introduced so slowly. Like, at first he was just visiting, and then he needed to couch surf for a little bit, and then he moved into a bedroom, and then all of a sudden he's like this permanent fixture. And slowly, slowly over months, he turned that group of students into a cult, and he was their leader. And that got me thinking about how at that age you are vulnerable and you're not fully formed yet, and you're really, really susceptible to that kind of manipulation if you fall under the spell of the wrong person. So while Only If You're Lucky is by no means a cult book, I did make one of the roommates, Lucy, kind of the ringleader. I gave her a lot of cult leader-like qualities because of that story. I wanted her to be like that cult leader at Sarah Lawrence, very charming, very manipulative, like very able to pull people's puppet strings. So that's a big piece of inspiration for this book, too.
And sometimes terrible things happen that has nothing to do with students' bad choices. Look at the Idaho murders, you know. So, you know, living off campus, living in, you know, in non-university housing sounds all that great. But in point of fact, you know, it can be dangerous as well, because, you know, that there's a layer of protection that doesn't come along with that. You know, so have any of you been down to ASU lately and seen the size of the campi? And I was invited to teach one afternoon at the Barrett Honors College. I couldn't believe it, because I taught at ASU in the 1990s, and it was still, it's now the biggest university in the country. There's over 100,000 students. So, and there, what are there now? Five campi, I think. East Mesa, down there, downtown, somewhere out west. And then there's one forming up at Mayo, a branch of the medical thing. So, you know, how do you control, is, you know, how does the university actually manage all that?
Right. And I think to your point, it is kind of the lack of oversight. Like, it's kind of every parent's worst nightmare. When a kid goes off to college, they're given all this independence for the very first time. And but they're still so young. They're still kids. And there's no oversight. So I kind of wanted to toy with this idea of all these girls, these 18-year-old girls living in this house together, having all this freedom. And no one really knows what's going on inside the house. No one really knows who these girls are and what they're capable of.
I brought up the honors thing because I think those students are required to live in housing. It's an enclosed kind of a campus with the, you know. And I thought, good, you know, I like that. Anyway, well, what else can we say? Because we're going to spoil this book if we take it a whole lot further.
I know. Thrillers in general are hard to talk about in depth, but I feel like this book in particular is a little tricky to talk about in depth. I mean, this book is pretty different. Has anyone here read A Flicker in the Dark or All the Dangerous Things? Oh, good. Okay. Yeah, so this book is pretty different than those two books. And I wanted to do something different. I think when you write full time, I just don't want to write the same book over and over again. So for me, I love dark academia. I've always loved The Secret History. I've always loved If We Were Villains by M.L. Rio. So I kind of took inspiration from those classic dark academia books and tried to put my own spin on it. And that's what this book turned out to be.
So that's an interesting point, because you were very successful with The Flicker of the Dark. And by the way, I apologize. I did order a whole bunch of them for tonight. And in the weather apparently prevented them from getting here from the Virginia warehouse. They'll probably come in, well, in the holiday unwell, because they probably would have delivered today. If you have a book business in this part of the country, all of the warehouses for all the publishers are on the East Coast. They're either in Virginia or New Jersey or Maryland. One's in Indiana. So it's always a complete crapshoot in the winter when the weather goes bad as to whether you're... So I really apologize. I ordered them on January 2nd, you know, so you'd think they would have made it. But anyway, they'll be here tomorrow, but unfortunately, Stacy won't. So
sorry.
There you are. So let's go back. You know, it's an interesting choice. When you have a successful first novel, there's a lot of pressure often to make it a series. Or you can elect to do what you're doing, which is to write, you know, unconnected stories, which means that everyone in your books is at risk. If you write a series, you know, some people, including the dog, have to survive. But if you're going to write standalones, everyone is in jeopardy, right? There's no guarantee that Lucy or will emerge alive from your story. So do you like that? Do you like that idea?
Yeah, I have yet to come up with an idea. I think the reason I gravitate towards standalones is I have a lot of ideas bouncing around at any given time. Right now I'm writing my fourth book. I know what my fifth is going to be. And I have a little seed of an idea for a sixth. And so I think pretty far ahead. And by the time I'm done writing one book, I have been thinking about the one that comes after it for a year, and I'm ready to write it. And so I have yet to come up with a story that I'm willing to set aside all the other ideas and continue that story and those characters. I also feel like I try to end my books fairly intentionally with some characters that have slightly open-ended endings, but I do that because I want the reader to talk about it afterwards. I want them to discuss with their friends or their book club what they think happened or what they want to happen. And so, I don't know, I've never really felt compelled to continue a character through multiple books.
Were you marked by Gone with the Wind? Gone with the Wind has the most open ending of almost any book that I can remember reading. You know, Scarlett says, you know, I'll go back to Tara and think about that tomorrow. And there are all kinds of things that Margaret Mitchell could have done, you know, to tell you what was going to happen. But it's so much better, you know, for you as the reader to try to figure that out. It's sort of like Rebecca, you know, the house burns down and really the house is the main character in the book. And people have tried to write, you know, because there's a terrible temptation on the part of some authors to write sequels to bestsellers for a variety of reasons. No one has yet written a successful sequel to Rebecca. And I don't think anybody's ever, there was one woman who tried to write a sequel. I think it was called The Wind Done Gone. Is that right? Does anybody remember that?
I've not heard. Yeah,
Patrick, look it up. Will you? Is there, there he comes, the voice in Patrick. Wasn't there a book called The Wind Done Gone or some sequel to Gone with the Wind some years ago? Thank you. See, normally this is where Patrick uses the chat function on Zoom. I will go, and all of a sudden a little box will pop up, and he's able to tell me what's going on. But anyway, I've always thought that Margaret really, you know, had the right idea there with ending it with a very open path for Scarlett.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a fine line. Some endings, if they're too open-ended, a reader is left unsatisfied and you're like, I just went down this 400 page journey and like, that's it. But
yeah, right.
I try to give it a satisfying conclusion, but then leave some threads open.
Sure.
So you can speculate about what you think happened next.
I love it. Am I right?
It's called Scarlet.
Yeah. Okay. But you sure there wasn't a book called The Wind Done Gone? I like that title. Maybe
you should write
I'm going to write that one. I know. I really, you know, I can't remember actual titles, but I'm really good on thinking up new titles. I read something. We have a really funny book coming up on January 30th by the podcaster who does the All About Agatha podcast. Have you ever listened to that? And it's really a wonderful book. The detective is a ghostwriter, and she's there to write the memoir of a woman and a senator in Maine based really on Margaret Chase Smith. Is kind of a, you know, tribute to Margaret Chase Smith. And funny stuff goes on. But one of the great things he says, he's talking about other classics and he says, you know, in Sherlock Holmes and in Poirot, there's a sidekick and the sidekick can't be too smart. But he said, Miss Marple works alone. And I thought, that is such a great book title, Miss Marple Works Alone. Somebody's going to steal it, you know. But the point is that she doesn't have a sidekick, you know, because she wants to do the whole detective thing on her own. It's really a funny book, so I hope maybe you can come back and meet him on January 30th. And now I've lost my point. What were we talking about?
Titles.
Titles, but right. So
actually, that's a good point. The title for Only If You're Lucky. So I'm currently 0-3 with titling my books. Every time I turn a book in with a title, my publisher's like, no, we're going to have to change that. And so now my fourth book that I'm writing right now is just untitled 4. I'm not even trying. But yeah, so
that's great. You're saving energy.
Yeah, because I get like emotionally attached and then
sure.
Inevitably they're like, no. So, but yeah, the process of titling a book, I guess, is so has anyone read Only If You're Lucky yet? I think a couple people. Yeah. Okay. Did you catch the title? Yeah. So it's, I try to title my books, A Flicker in the Dark, All the Dangerous Things, and now Only If You're Lucky. I pull it from the book, which I think is kind of fun. I try to find like a little nugget in the book that means something. So when the reader finally comes across it, they're like, oh, like that's why. So, but the original title was One of Us. Because Margot found herself kind of pulled into this group and she felt like, oh, there was a line where one of the girls said, you're one of us now. And I thought that was a really creepy kind of powerful line. But there's been a handful of books come out recently with One of Us in the title. And so that was part of the reason why my publisher nixed that.
Well, only if you're lucky actually implies a number of things that, you know, one of us does not. But you, I don't know if you all know that titles are not copyrighted, so there could actually be 18 books coming out right now called Only If You're Lucky, which can be confusing for you if you're going to order a book. Also, the author doesn't get to choose the cover either, although sometimes the publisher will consult the author, but the publisher actually owns the artwork.
Yes, that's correct. But I have, my experience has been phenomenal because they actually do give me a lot of input with my covers. For A Flicker in the Dark, I knew I wanted fireflies on it. I actually was a little obnoxious with that cover because I was very specific about what I wanted. I wanted fireflies, and I knew I wanted the font to be like kind of glowy. And they played around a little bit. At the first iteration of that cover, they had fireflies like writing the title. Like it was basically like they had been zipping around. And so we looked at that for a little bit and eventually landed on the cover for Flicker. And then All the Dangerous Things was actually, I sent the designer a picture of my parents' backyard, because my parents live on the marsh in South Carolina, and I spent a lot of time sitting out there thinking and coming up with a lot of the scenes. And so it was a picture of the water with the Spanish moss and the marsh grass and stuff, and that's pretty much the exact cover for All the Dangerous Things. And then Only If You're Lucky, I had a harder time. Like, I didn't have an exact vision in mind for this one. The obvious visual was the house that the girls live in, but I wasn't completely sold on it. So so I just told the designer, like, have fun and let me see what you come up with. And they came up with that on the first try. It's the first one they sent me. Yeah. And I thought they did a really good job.
The colors are really interesting.
Yeah.
I know. Right. They also today, it's not just about the book, but they have to create a JPEG that will do well, you know, in social media and all the rest of it. So there's a question. I have absolutely no experience with college and social media, obviously, back in 1958. To what degree, you know, did you think about the social media as a driving force in your story, or did you discard it as irrelevant?
I actually completely left it out intentionally. Cell phones, too. So if you'll... Some people have, early readers have said, you know, this seems a little like not present day because they're never on their phones. But I just didn't, you know, if you keep true to the time period, they're going to be on their phones all the time. And it's like, who wants to read a book about that, you know? And so, you may notice that they never have cell phones. They're not on social media. I just kind of intentionally left it out. So that may not be realistic, but I think it makes for a better story.
Or you can think it was maybe set in the 1990s and she just didn't tell you. But no, you're right. I mean, you know, now you go out to dinner and you see people in restaurants, you know, four or five people around a table and nobody's talking to, you know, everybody's on their phone and, you know, not talking to each other. It's quite bizarre. I intentionally don't have any social media. I do the Instagram for the bookstore, and what tiny bit of social media I do comes from that. But, you know,
it's a good choice.
Well, it doesn't really have any resonance in my personal life, so why go there? Yep. Right. So, questions. What would you all like to ask Stacy? Christina.
Hi. Hey, what do you want to share about the Beatles song?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a great question. Yeah, so, all right, so I mentioned all of my books. When people ask about the inspiration behind my books, it's never one thing. It's usually like three or four or five things that kind of stick in my brain for some reason. And then all of a sudden one day they all kind of click into one cohesive idea. And so for Only If You're Lucky, it was the three pieces of inspiration were, one, that house I lived in college, which I told you guys about. Two, the cult at Sarah Lawrence College, which I mentioned. And then the third thing was actually a Beatles song. So this house I lived in college, my friends and I, when we first moved in, we went to a record store in downtown Athens and bought a bunch of old vinyl records, and we decorated the walls with all these old vinyl record covers. And it was like the Doors and AC/DC and Jimi Hendrix and the Beatles. So when I first started plotting this book, I was listening to all that music to try and put myself like back in the house. And I listened to, all of a sudden, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds came on. And the first lines of that song are, picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you, you answer quite slowly, a girl with kaleidoscope eyes. And I saw, like, very weirdly, I just saw this scene in my head of a bunch of kids on a boat because they're in a coastal college and the sun is setting. So the sky is orange and the water's orange. And someone in the back of the boat is calling your name. And there's something about this girl who's so magnetic. Even if you don't want to turn around and acknowledge her, like you have to, like she just, you have to turn around and look at her. And so you turn around and you look at her and it's this girl with these really magnetic eyes. And that became Lucy. So you'll notice that scene. It's in chapter 48. I came up with that scene and I kind of wrote it frantically. And that was the first thing I wrote of this book. And then it made its way into the final draft in chapter 48.
Hey.
That was a good question.
So Christina, who asked that question, is going to be a published author. She's going to debut her book here on March 25th. It's
Yay!
Set here in Phoenix. It's set here in Phoenix, and it will awake you to modern journalism, where social media actually may have taken it over. Right, Christina? I read it the other day. It definitely social media, right? Really, and also wonderful stuff about Phoenix. We don't have as many authors in this giant city as many smaller cities have, and so every time we get a new one, I'm really excited. You know that we have a local author. Right?
Are you? You're with Minotaur?
Yes.
Yeah, we have the same publisher.
That's right.
Yeah. Yep.
Christina is very good about coming out to support all the Minotaur authors too. So, and she takes photos, which I then use for. Yeah, Instagram, right? I probably should give you more photo credit lines than I ever do. Sorry about that. Right. Right. Another question? Who else would like to ask one? Okay.
Former bulldog, go dogs.
Go dogs. Yeah, I've heard that.
I love that.
Well, thank you.
I love that part. There was a quote, and my daughter, my sister, and I, we've read the book, and there was the "Only if you're lucky" line, mm-hmm. and we're still confused.
Okay.
You know, you're only young once, but only if you're lucky. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you can address that.
I won't get into too many spoilers, but when when that line comes up in the beginning of the book, basically Margot is grieving the death of her best friend Eliza, and she's talking about how Eliza was this very, she lived life like she was never going to die. I mean, basically like most high schoolers, she thought she was invincible, and so she did all the things that you do when you're young. She drove really fast in her car and didn't wear a seatbelt. She dove into the marsh at low tide and didn't even think about it. She drank too much when she was underage. And Margot says, you're only young once and only if you're lucky, because Margot was young, but she didn't get to grow up, is basically where that line came from. Oh, yeah, that's a good question. So A Flicker in the Dark. So A Flicker in the Dark, I never landed on a title I really loved, but I wrote the book. It took me almost two years to write it and get it to a point when I was ready to submit it to agents and editors. And so I just threw a title on there because I was like obsessing over it and I couldn't find one I liked. So it was The Shadows. And the marketing team at Minotaur actually worked that title into their marketing copy, because the tagline of A Flicker in the Dark is "Some Shadows Never Disappear." So that came from the original title. And it's actually a really great thing that we changed it, because Alex North's The Shadows came out not long before A Flicker in the Dark did. So it was the right choice. And then All the Dangerous Things is a book about a mother searching for her missing son, and she is also a severe insomniac, and that title was Hush Little Baby. I know, I thought it was good too. But I also love All the Dangerous Things. Yeah, my process is it's chaotic. I honestly don't have much of a process. I'm a pantser. Has anyone heard of plotters versus pantsers? So a plotter is someone who plots out their books. They like meticulously outline. They know exactly what's going to happen. A pantser is someone who flies by the seat of their pants.
Basically, you make shit up as you go along.
I make shit up as I go. I every day when I sit down at the laptop, I'm like, so what now? And I just kind of figure it out. But I do know I have my big idea. I have my main character and I do know the twist. So like I know the main twist at the end because I have to at least know kind of in what direction I'm going. But everything in the middle, I just make up as I go. I also do what pretty much every editor tells you not to do. And I edit as I go. So a lot of times the advice is just don't edit, get a bad first draft down and then go back and edit. I edit as I go. So sometimes it will take me a year to write my first draft, but I've found that at least with these last few books, by the time my first draft is done, it still needs some work, but it's not horrible. You know, I mean, I've gotten the horrible, I wrote the horrible stuff, but I edited it as I went and it slowly got better with every iteration. So yeah, that's my process. And I usually start every day with reading someone else's work, like an author I admire, because it just helps me feel creative and it reminds me what good writing sounds like. And then I try to sit down and write between like 10 and 3. And that's when I feel the most creative. And then outside of those hours, I do like admin, marketing, emails, stuff like that.
So if you're a pantser, do you find that when you're editing every day, you must go down some real rabbit holes from time to time and you have to, you know, make some serious adjustments?
Yes. Well, I think that's why I edit as I go, because I am a pantser. I will think the story is going one way and then all of a sudden I change my mind and I realize it shouldn't go that way. It should go this way. And then I have to change so many things I just wrote. And so I actually don't know how people don't edit as they go, because it would not make any sense if I just kept going without changing what came before it.
Well, I mean, you know, it's a lot of work to outline, but it's also a lot of work to rewrite. So, you know, probably in the end, it's the same amount of energy. It's just, you know, done differently. Patrick, do you have a couple of online questions?
I do. Yeah.
Okay.
And actually, you were right. The Wind Done Gone was a novel. It was written by Alice Randall.
That's it.
And it tells an alternative account of the story.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
You knew
Great.
It.
Great. Let's see. What does your writing process... You just answered that? Okay. Okay. Fred would like to know, of the three books you've written so far, or published so far, which one was the most fun to write?
Oh, I like that. Because everyone always asks what my favorite is, and that's impossible to answer. Only If You're Lucky was the most fun to write. For sure, I think. And I think that's because, one, there was a personal element to it. I got to revisit some real memories. And two, it was kind of scary doing something different. Like we were talking about, I've had a good amount of success with A Flicker in the Dark and All the Dangerous Things. And the idea of doing something different, I was like, are people going to like this? Like, what am I doing? But it also kind of brought an element of freedom, creative freedom to it that I really enjoyed.
And who do you like to read? Who are some of your favorites?
Oh, yeah. So I love mysteries, literary mysteries, just beautifully well-written. I don't even know if I'd classify them as thrillers, but well-written mysteries. And for me, that is Emma Klein, Megan Abbott, Tana French. I love Donna Tartt, of course. Gillian Flynn will always be one of my favorites. Those are my top authors.
Some of those authors, like Donna Tartt, take like 10 years per book.
She does.
Gillian hasn't written another book since 2011, but you'll be glad to know that Tana French has a book out in March.
I saw that. Yeah. I'm excited for it.
So that's very exciting. Right. Anybody else? Yes, ma'am.
They love it. They're all, my friends from college, the ones, yeah, they love it. They think it's the coolest thing ever, except they're all wondering if they're like, who's the evil one? Like, and I'll never tell.
How do you keep track of all the details of the characters as you write the story?
Honestly, it's just all in my head. Like in the very, very beginning, when I'm still getting a feel for the story, I'll get a Word doc and I'll just write every character name, and I'll say, like, Lucy, black hair, ringlet curls, blue eyes, Margot. Like, this, like, I'll just very simple, like, this is their names, this is what they look like. So I can kind of get it straight in the beginning, but by the time I'm at least a couple chapters in, they've all turned so real in my head, I don't even really need to reference it anymore. It's just all in my head.
Here's an interesting question. This comes up a lot at events. How do you come up with their names? I mean, I've heard some authors give the most amazing answers. They read, you know, like political polls or, you know, graveyard stones or, you know, whatever it is, trying to come up with names.
So the name Lucy is my most interesting name, because the name Lucy actually came from that song, and that's kind of a cool story. The rest of them, they just sound right. Like, sometimes I'll name a character and I'll write for a couple chapters and it just doesn't click. It just doesn't feel right. And so then I'll go back and change it and write for a couple chapters and see how that feels. And if it doesn't feel right, I'll go back and change it. For, like, secondary and tertiary characters, though, what I do is I have a bookshelf in my office that when I'm sitting in my chair writing, I can see the spines of all the books. And sometimes I will just grab names from the spines. So, like, let's see. An example is, like, in a flicker in the Dark, there's a character named Tara King. And on my bookshelf that day was Educated by Tara Westover and Stephen King.
You know, but if you're writing, you know, names come in vogue. You know, you've probably seen polls about, you know, what's the most, I'm trying to remember, I should remember what the most common boy's name, I saw one the other day. But anyway, if you're writing anything historical, you have to go back and find names that, mm-hmm. you know, were actually, but you also have to be careful if you're writing contemporary that you don't call somebody like Hepzibah. You know, which is a great name back in whenever the 18th century, but wouldn't resonate all that much today. Although maybe there is an occasion when you would deliberately take an anachronistic or unpopular name for various reasons.
Yeah. And, like, one example is in All the Dangerous Things, my main character, Isabel, came from, like, a very regal Southern family in a long line of Southern congressmen. And I made their last name Rhett because that's a very common old Southern name in Charleston. So yeah, I mean, I'll make choices like that sometimes to make sure it fits with the setting and who the character is supposed to be.
Right. Patrick, you're back. Patrick actually exists. He's right around the corner.
I'm here, yeah.
He's actually keeping up with the Facebook and questions.
The question is, what is the title of Christina's book again?
Oh, Off the Air.
Off the Air.
Off the Air.
There we go.
Which is a title that has more than one meaning. Once you read the book, you will know why. Yes. It's a great title, actually. Beautiful cover, too. Was that your title? Good girl.
They let you keep your title?
Yeah. No. Oh, title envy going on. Here we go. That's so much fun. Is that it? Okay. Anybody else here in the audience? Oh, lots of hands now. Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I wrote a whole book before Flicker in the Dark that never got published. Yeah, so my Flicker in the Dark is technically my second book. It's my debut because it's my first published book. But yeah, I spent 3 years writing a book, the very first book I ever wrote, and then another 2 years trying to get an agent for it, and I got rejected by 115 of them. And so after 5 years of trying to make that book happen, I just set it aside, and then I came up with the idea for Flicker. So, that book I'm never going to do anything with because I'm over it. I did kind of start another book after Flicker and before All the Dangerous Things that just wasn't clicking. I think I got like maybe 3 chapters in and I was like, no. And there's elements to it that I'll probably reuse. Like, I don't think I'll ever go back to old book ideas that for one reason or another didn't pan out, but I will reuse like scenes. Like if there was a really good scene in one book, I'll just refit it to another story.
Anybody else? Back over there.
Why'd you go back to college with this one? Because I would never go back to college.
I mean, honestly, it stemmed from my love of dark academia. I mean, it's just a genre that I love. I can never get enough of those books, and I really enjoy reading them. And one day I was like, I'm going to try writing one. I mean, if I like reading them, I'd probably like writing it. And I did. I had a lot of fun. So,
yeah.
No. Like, to the point where I will, like, write at my kitchen table and my husband will walk behind me to go to the fridge and I'll, like, lower my laptop and he's like, I am not reading. Like, I swear. So, yeah, I'm really private. Yeah, really private. I don't let anyone read it until I think I've got it as close as I can possibly get it to finished. And then, it inevitably needs edits. But, yeah, I keep it to myself.
And then it goes to your editor. And that's a collaborative process because the editor, you know, is reading it for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I found in all the years that I was editing that the thing that came up the most often was not taking stuff out, because I mean, many people think editors are just there to slash and burn, you know, but it was the stuff that didn't get written. And I would say to the author, Sal, what did you mean here? And they would give me an answer. And then I would say, but you didn't write it into the book. And I think the thing is that in your head, you know it, but you don't always remember to, you know, it doesn't always come out on the page. And therefore, the reader is left somewhat adrift. And that's really the big role of the editor, I think.
That's exactly what my editor does. She has never asked me to cut or remove anything. If anything, she'll question something. She'll say, this doesn't make sense. Why would this character do this? I don't understand. I'm not following this. And then I'll explain it to her. And she's like, okay, I get it. But the reader doesn't get it. So you have to explain it better. So yeah, it's exactly the same.
There are ethical standards for editors. I broke one once. But I had an author whom I truly loved and wrote a really great book and absolutely ruined it with a one-page epilogue. I mean, it was just awful. And I really wrestled with myself. And then finally, I just tore it out and sent it off to the printer. And the thing was so great is he didn't notice.
He didn't even notice.
No. And I hated myself afterward. I really did, because that was such an awful thing to do. An editor should never do that.
Has he still to this day never noticed?
I'm not sure. The book did really well, so probably became a moot question. But, this was a very stubborn author, and I was pretty sure that a negotiation wouldn't work. Yeah. Right. So you have to know that. I mean, you know, I've edited almost 900 books, and that was the only one where it really went bad.
When I get my hardbacks in, I cannot read my books after they're printed, because for me, I'm going to read it. I'm going to find something that bothers me. And at this point, it's too late. And so I get my hardbacks and I'm like, oh, beautiful. And then that's it. Right. So he maybe just never even opened the book.
Probably. So, you know, and that's a really good point that we should end on for all of you. You have to remember that the author wrote the book the author wanted, and you don't get to rewrite it because it doesn't suit you. You can rewrite it in your head, but I read, you know, reviews and comments, you know, on Goodreads or whatever, when I really go there. And I think, why is this person wasting their time talking about how this book should have been? It's too late. You know, it's already out there in the world. And that's the book that you wanted to write. And after all, it really is your story.
Yeah. I mean, on the one hand, I think all authors want to satisfy our readers. Like, I want to give you guys something that you like. That's extremely important to me. But if I'm trying to force myself to write a book that I'm not passionate about, it's not going to be good. And so at the end of the day, it's whatever idea that I'm excited about, that's the book. I strive to write the book that I want to write and be 100% happy with it, and then just hope that the readers feel the same way. I think that's really the only way to go about it.
Well, just don't torture yourself by reading, you know, reviews that suggest that you could have written it differently.
Yeah, I don't. Good. Oof. I mean, if I want to hurt myself, I'll go to Goodreads, but I rarely go there anymore.
Right.
I learned that lesson a couple
years ago.
We won't
even go into the... Do you all know about the Goodreads scandal? So there's a new author, currently not going to be published, but anyway, conceived the idea that if she... I'm trying to remember, was it 87 or 67? Anyway, created either 67 or 87 false identities and then went on Goodreads and trashed all the similar books with the idea that that would make her book sell better. Now, A, that amount of energy could have been spent on positive marketing. B, why would anyone think that they actually could get away with that? Because, you know, nothing you do online is impenetrable. C, lost her agent, lost her publishing contract. Whatever, but also threw Goodreads into pretty a turmoil. And I also got a notice today from Meta. I have trouble calling it Meta. Anyway, no, I'm sorry, from Google, in which they said they were going to toughen up their policies as of February 1st in terms of what, in quotes, sensitive content, meaning that if you post and it triggers off, you know, some bot out there saying, you know, no, you can't really talk about this or that, or you're trying to sensationalize something, or you're trying to capitalize. Anyway, they're going to try to police it. And I think myself that there's way too little policing, and, you know, I won't even go to X, formerly known as Twitter. If you notice that that's what the media always call it, X, formerly known as Twitter. I mean, it's like suddenly Twitter has a much longer name than it ever had before. But, you know, I think it's an interesting thing that Elon Musk apparently wants no control. And as a result, other, you know, other platforms are now looking for more control. So it'll be curious to see. I'll be curious to see how that all goes. So I want to thank you all for your attention this evening. Thank you, virtual audience. And now we're going to come to the part where, having thanked you and thanked Stacy, I'm going to give away a book. So that's why you have a number in your book. A, for those of you who bought one, is that's the signing line number. So we don't all crowd up to be the number one fan. Although I am going to let the lady whose husband is still in the back room go first, and I hope nobody will object to that. And this is a book. It's a brand new book called The Storm We Made by Vanessa Chan. It has absolutely no relevance to Stacy's books at all, except that it's about a woman who made spectacularly bad choices.
So they're the
and
same.
as a consequence, became a really bad parent. And we're in Malaya in 1945, now known as Malaysia. And Cicely, who's, I'm trying to remember, I think she may be part Malaysian and part British. Anyway, really resents the British, and so she decides to spy for the Japanese, little realizing, and she decides to do that 10 years earlier, and little realizes the effect that's going to have on the Japanese coming to Malaysia. She's the one who, I think in this book, suggested, because the British guns were all pointed towards the sea and the harbors to defend Malaysia. I had no idea this was true. It's amazing how you can keep learning stuff. The Japanese invaded riding bicycles because the British guns were all facing out and they weren't facing in. Who knew? I mean, who knew? So you can always learn stuff from historical fiction, even if it's actual fiction. But anyway, it's a book that's getting a lot of conversation, and it's a really interesting book. So, Stacy, wait, John, how many numbers do we have?
31.
Thank you. I love John. He always yells loud enough so I can hear him. Right. You want to pick a number between 1 and 31?
Yes. I'm going to pick 16.
There you are. Yay! Great. All right. You get Vanessa Chan. And for any of you who are interested in this, the book is called The Storm We Made by Vanessa Chan. I hope you enjoy it. You bet. So let's give Stacy a round of applause for coming
to
join
us. Thank you, guys.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.